You'd like to turn back in your Bibles, please, to Genesis and chapter 44, where we had our reading this evening, 44 and 45. So throughout this account of the second visit of Joseph's brothers, there are comparisons made with the previous one, that first visit that Joseph's brothers paid when, of course, Simeon was left there with Joseph. So I think really to appreciate the full flavour of this account, we need to look at those two visits together. So I am going to ask you to cast your eye back to chapter 43 in a moment, and 42 as well, just as a means of introduction. But the visit doesn't just look backward. It actually looks forward as well. It looks forward to the third journey. It preempts that third journey when the whole family would come together to Egypt. So we look back to the first journey to understand the second journey. And then, of course, we look forward to that third visit when they all came together. Now, this passage this evening, as you have probably gathered already from listening to our young people read it so well, it does involve high emotion. And once again, we're going to see an overflow of tears, of weeping, but also a true heart for relationships as reconciliation and freedom are finally found. Reconciliation and freedom. Now, you may have seen the tears on the news this week from an NHS surgeon called David Knott, who had operated on a little five-month-old Syrian girl called Maram, whose legs and left arm had been shattered by a bomb blast in Syria. And she had shrapnel piercing her tiny little body when he operated on her in the most horrendous conditions in a Syrian hospital with very little to work with. Her parents had been killed in the blast. And after the British doctor had saved her life, she was evacuated to Turkey. And the BBC had managed to track her down 5-6 months later to where she was in Turkey. And they reunited David Knott, the surgeon, with her for the first time. And if you saw it on the news, the moment he walked into the room, the emotion was intense as he saw this little girl again who he'd saved the life of. And he cried and he wept as he saw her, and told her how beautiful she was, gave her the present that he had for her. The emotion was there and it was raw. You couldn't fail to be touched by watching that. You really, really couldn't. And that heartache, that suffering, the bonding, the sacrifice that doctor made, the emotion, but also that ultimate hope. It was a hopeful, it was a really uplifting item to watch on the news. And it's not like that often, is it? Often we watch the news and feel quite depressed. It was so uplifting to watch it. And it left us with a feeling of that hope and reconciliation. Now, those ingredients are all here in tonight's passage. All of those things I've just mentioned. The sacrifice, the love, that bonding, that emotion, and that hope and reconciliation are all here, which we will see. So Jacob was still head of the family. And until he withdrew his opposition to this second visit, they weren't going to go. The brothers were going nowhere. But at last, he relents. Why does he relent? One, he was hungry. There was a famine and they had no food left. And secondly, there were some reassurances made about Benjamin, the youngest. He was told that Benjamin would be looked after at all costs. And that's what Judah reassured him with. But Jacob's prayer in chapter 32 and his general attitude to the predicament doesn't really show a great deal of faith. Actually, it shows quite a feeble faith. Perhaps we can identify with that a little bit ourselves. He kind of basically was saying, well, if Benjamin and Simeon come back, that'll be a result. I'll be happy if those two come back. You know, that'll be good. But I don't really sort of fancy the chances of the rest of you. But God and his mercy was going to far outrun this expectation that Jacob had, because God's mercy was far, far greater than this. So if Jacob was full of apprehension about Benjamin's safety, then the sons, the brothers, were terrified about their previous sins finally catching up with them. Have you noticed when we read it, that whenever anything unexpected happens, how do the brothers react? Panic. Panic overtakes them. And why? Because their uneasy conscience interpreted everything according to the sins they'd committed in selling Joseph. How do you think they must have felt then in chapter 43? Have a look at chapter 43. And verse 33. Just turn back to that. I'll give you a second to look. 43 and 33, verse 33. Joseph is seated before them. He seats them before him, in order of their ages, from the firstborn to the youngest. How on earth does he know the age of the order of the brothers? They didn't know who this man was. They just saw him as a holy man. He was in charge, and yet he put the brothers in order. Well, look at their reaction. They were astonished. But I guess it was a bit more than astonishment. I guess confusion, perhaps feeling a little bit disorientated, perhaps anxious. How does this man know? What's this man playing at? Because, of course, when Joseph met them, in chapter 43 and 26, we see that he was full of kindness. He asked about their aging father, his father, of course. He blessed Benjamin, and he treated them to a lavish feast, a banquet. Pretty good. What happened the last time? This is why we need to look at the two accounts together, the contrast between the first visit. The first time they arrived, very different. There was harsh questions. He put them through the mill, didn't he? Through the ringer. And he made their lives difficult. And this must have thrown them as well. One minute, he's given them a hard time. They go back, and he couldn't be nicer. He couldn't be kinder. He couldn't be more open to them. A bit like, isn't it, sometimes the effect of Mr. Donald Trump. One minute nice, the next minute nasty. Vitriolic on Twitter, and then we find him before Congress this week, the perfect statesman in fulfilling his role. It throws people, doesn't it? It unnerves people when he's like that. Who is he really? Well, the brothers, who is this man? One minute he's nice, the next minute he's not. One minute he's giving us a hard time, the next minute, look, what's going on? It unnerved them, it confused them, and it made them feel very anxious, particularly living with the conscience that they did. So the next morning, just as they were congratulating themselves on being able to leave Egypt, they had everything they wanted. They had Simeon, who had been left in the first visit. They had plentiful food supplies, which was pretty good because there was a famine going on. And they had Benjamin, which was a relief because Jacob, of course, wasn't going to survive without him. But then their whole world collapses with a huge dose of fake news, of alternative facts. They were going to be welcomed to the post-truth world, if you like, because something was going to happen that they really weren't expecting. So if you look at chapter 44 and those first 17 verses, we're going to look just now at the arrest of Benjamin. The arrest of Benjamin. Just have a look. Because Joseph's strategy had already been brilliantly successful in creating the tension and creating the situation he needed for this final masterstroke. What was his final masterstroke? What was he going to do? Well, it was the threat to Benjamin, the one that had to come back, the favourite, one of the favourites, along with Joseph. He had to come back. This would have been like a dagger to the heart of the brothers when they suddenly found that Benjamin was at risk. Did you notice in verse 10 how the steward waters down the brothers' response? In verse 9, the brothers say, have a look at verse 9, if any of your servants is found to have it, that's the silver cup which Joseph drank from, he will die and the rest of us will become my Lord's slaves. That's what they said. They were so sure of themselves that if that cup was to be found in one of those sacks, the person that did it, you can kill them. And what's more, the rest of us will be your slaves. This wasn't going to happen. A bit like perhaps at the Oscars, the mix-up. It wasn't going to happen, was it? We don't get envelopes mixed up. PricewaterhouseCoopers have been doing it for 80 years. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. But envelopes can get mixed up just as sacks and cups can get mixed up. And we see the response of the steward in verse 10. Have a look, verse 10. He says, very well then, let it be as you say. Whoever is found to have it will become my slave, and the rest of you will be free from blame. Hang on. Very well then, let it be as you say. That's not what they said. The person that found it would die, and the others will be slaves. He says, whoever's found it will become my slave, and the rest of you, you'll be free. Not quite the fact they'd said, was it? Perhaps another alternative fact. But once again, it gave the brothers the perfect opportunity. The perfect opportunity for another betrayal. And this time, there was a more compelling price, wasn't there? their liberty. Last time, what did they get for Joseph? 20 pieces of silver. This time, it was their freedom that was on the line. But how do they respond this time? Well, their response is threefold. It's unanimous, it's direct, and it's consistent. They all agree they're not going to change their minds. And even if you look in verse 17, Joseph makes a similar offer. Have a look at 44:17. He gives them the same opportunity for betrayal. He says, whoever it was, I'll take him. The rest of you, you can scuttle off. But they don't take it. They don't take that opportunity. It showed that the chastening had done its work. The chastening had done its work. And the preceding speech by Judah will emphasize this, as you'll see in a minute, that actually things had changed big time. But it's interesting to note, though, this cup was used by Joseph for drinking. It wasn't really a clever item to have nicked, was it? He used it every day for drinking, and this item was meant to have been stolen. I mean, I know the reaction of teachers in the staff room if somebody uses their mug, you know? It's carnage, absolute carnage if someone takes their cup. So you imagine Joseph losing the cup that he drinks out of every day. And you might also have noticed that it was also doubly precious. Why was it doubly precious? Anyone? Why was it doubly precious? What else? What other purpose did it serve? Yeah, it was used for divination. Now, when I first read that, I thought, what does that mean? Used for divination. Does it mean that he was involved in some sort of crystal ball gazing? Some sort of looking at the way the liquids flow to work out what's going to be happening in the next few years and the next few decades? What was this all about, this divination? It was also a practice, apparently, that was alien to Israel and also to Egypt at this time. This divining, this divination. And also for a man of God who explicitly had God's will revealed to him. Why would he need a cup like this? Well, it's likely that the word divining here is about detecting. And it's actually Joseph detecting what the brothers were meant to have done. And he uses this to his advantage. Look at verse 15. He explains to his brothers how he knew. He says, don't you know that a man like me can find things out by divination? Well, he put it in there himself, hadn't he? He didn't need to find out through divination. It was an excuse, really, for his brothers to see that actually there was other things at work. But I think maybe that needs a bit of further investigation. I'll leave you to have a think about that at your leisure. But it's just to raise that. But the key point is in verse 16 that God has uncovered your servant's guilt. Verse 16, God has uncovered your servant's guilt. And perhaps Judah spoke far better than he knew. Let's move on to 18 to 34 of chapter 44. Cast your eyes over that. Because the world of Judah and his brothers had been built on what? Hatred, lies, and deception. And that had now come crashing down. That had collapsed in a big way. And the hard-hearted Judah, who had proposed the sale of his brother Joseph, who had lied to his dad and said he'd been mauled by some sort of wild animal, and then, of course, demanded that his daughter-in-law be put to death. If you look back in chapter 38 and verse 24... Judah says of Tamar, who is his daughter-in-law, he says this, bring her out and have her burned to death. That's what he says, bring her out and have her burned to death for her misdemeanors. But now this Judah shows himself to be a changed man. And apparently this is the longest speech in Genesis, and I would put it to you, it's probably one of the most eloquent, one of the most moving of all petitions that we see in God's word. As he pleads for Benjamin's release, he touchingly describes what it would be like for his dad not to have him coming home. And finally, he offers to take his brother's place. It's a great petition, full of passion, full of love, and the words of a changed man. It's now abundantly clear that the age-old animosity between the sons of Leah, which of course was Judah, and the sons of Rachel, that's Joseph and Benjamin, was over. And despite Jacob's preference, and perhaps we'd argue his favouritism, Egyptian slavery was preferential to them, to their father's heart being broken. They were prepared to take that risk. Look at verse 33 and 34. I'll just read that to you. It says, "Now then, please let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come on my father." Thinking of his father's interests, thinking of other people before himself. And this selfless concern, and the great spirit of this speech, really, you could compare it to Moses in Exodus, though of course that was made by the innocent for the guilty, but it's a similar kind of thing. And also perhaps reminds us of Jonathan's devotion to David in a similar kind of way in 1 Samuel 18. But Judah's readiness to sacrifice himself for his brothers and his father allowed Joseph to reveal his true identity. It was only when he realised they'd finally changed that he could reveal who he was. Now, it wasn't like the Japanese couple in the news this week. I don't know if you heard about the Japanese couple who had a falling out. They had an argument. Apparently, it was about 18 years ago. And they have stayed together as a couple under the same roof, but they haven't spoken since. Haven't spoken for 18 years. She's tried to speak to him, apparently. And the most she's got out of him in 18 years is a nod and a grunt. That's all she's got. The rest of the time, he's been silent. Now, that is a pretty incredible sulk, isn't it? And I thought I was good at sulking, but that really is pretty good. Not speaking to his wife for 18 years under the same roof. But Joseph was not sulking. He was not sulking. He wasn't feeling hard done by. He was waiting for his brothers to show remorse, true remorse. He was waiting for self-sacrifice and real change. He wanted to know that things were different. This was no big, incredible sulk. And it's true, isn't it, in family feuds and arguments. Arguments with people at work, falling out with our friends. Are we prepared to put our own interests and pride second? Sacrifice ourselves, even admit our faults. Only then can things really change. And that challenges me, and I hope that challenges you. And then we move on to chapter 45, those last 15 verses. Now, as I prepared these verses, I have to say that I was greatly encouraged by what I read. It made a huge difference to me, and I hope it does to you, because the certainty that God's will and not ours was controlling reality in every event, and it shines out as Joseph's guiding light and the secret for his astonishing lack of bitterness and vitriol. That's what you'd expect, wouldn't you? A real sense of bitterness towards his brothers. A reaction of real vitriol. And yet there's not that at all. Because he knew that it was God that was controlling that situation. God was in charge. In Packer's great book, Jim Packer's book, Concise Theology, he says that true theology always leads to doxology. True theology is not dry and meaningless and sitting on a shelf. It always leads to doxology, to the praise, to action. And I think what we see here in Genesis 45 is a great example of applied theology. It's living theology. It's God's truth releasing the will for constructive effort. And not only that, but the emotions for healing affection. That's what God's truth does. It releases the will for that effort that has to be constructive, but the emotions that come with that to heal those wounds that have been created. It's amazing. And do we really believe that God can do that? Because he can. Yes, there's strong feeling. Look at Joseph. He asked everyone to leave the room. Look at verse 1 of chapter 45. He asked them all to leave, and he wept so loudly that the Egyptians still heard him, and they gave Pharaoh the nod and said, "Guess what? We hear these tears and the weeping. It's so loud that we've been left the court and we can still hear it." This is real emotion. These were tears that he felt very, very strongly. But it was combined with sound spiritual argument that completed the work of reconciliation. Now, in those early stages, it called for almost surgical severity, didn't it, in order to restore this relationship. But Joseph proves that as a whole person, he was going to be patiently approaching this with conviction. And he was not going to act on mere impulse. And it would have been so tempting, wouldn't it, having seen his brothers again, to act on impulse. But no, he was a man of conviction, and things were going to happen at the right time, and in fact, in God's time. In verse 5, we see the words, You sold me, and God sent me. And this is perhaps one of the classic statements of providential control. You sold me, and God sent me. So we're talking about the biblical realism of the human factor, the brother's sin, but the perfect will of God. And those two things are really hard to get our head around. It's not easy. But look at where the emphasis is. Look at verse 8, because the emphasis is always on the latter. Verse 8 says, "It is not you who sent me here, but God." It's not you who sent me here, but God. And in fact, that verse is a great summary of the story of Joseph. If you want to summarize it in one sentence, that's your sentence. That's the one. It's not you who sent me here, but God. And for that reason, God, in verse 7, had preserved them as a family, and he saved them by a great deliverance. Abraham and his offspring were promised they'd be blessed, and actually, through Joseph's famine relief program, that's continued, and that's partially fulfilled. He's part of the line we see where that nation would be preserved, and God would bless them. And I really like this. When Joseph repeats words for his father in verse 9, the words that he wants are not, "I am the ruler of Egypt. I have become a very important person." He says the first word in verse 9, "God has made me Lord of all Egypt." God has done it. I'm not here by chance. I'm not here because I'm a particularly good person or because I've done well for myself. I'm here because God has made me Lord of all Egypt. But this emphasis in Genesis 45 of God's sovereignty, and this is really important, controlling human affairs, it doesn't deny our moral responsibility for what we do. I just want to say that. It doesn't deny any of us that moral responsibility for what we do. Because look, we see deep hurt caused by the brother's wicked actions. We see Jacob's terrible grief. We see Joseph's slavery and unjust imprisonment. And the brothers living with their guilty conscience. That's not just, "Oh, well, it's down to God, let's just see what happens." That's real consequences for people that have made real mistakes. But if this belief in human guilt and responsibility that we see, and it actually lies behind the harsh treatment of his brothers, you might think perhaps Joseph is being rather harsh on them. I don't know how you feel about that. But actually, that's a result of taking sin seriously, that what they did had consequences. And that's why he reacts, Joseph, in the way that he does to them initially. But it's not until Judah confessed their guilt and offered to take Benjamin's place that true reconciliation is possible. And this is really important. Joseph had forgiven them, yeah? He'd forgiven them for what they'd done a long time before that. But there's a difference between forgiveness and reconciliation. Because that reconciliation was not possible until those brothers had moved into a position where they'd changed and they'd actually showed they were going to be different. They had a chance to go and do the same thing again. They didn't take it. They showed they were different. And that allowed Joseph to be reconciled to his brothers. So yes, he can forgive them, but forgiveness doesn't equal reconciliation, because that comes when both parties, or in this case, the brothers, had to move and shift and change the way they were. And then what do we see? It's like the floodgates open, isn't it? The floodgates open. Because it's not just weeping that we see, but what else? His generosity knows no bounds. He makes every provision for their homeward journey and their return back. Plus, he gives them Goshen. And what's Goshen known for? A place of fertility. A land which is going to produce for them. A fertile district. And it was close to Joseph's courts. And it was for all the family. Grandchildren, animals, the lot. You're all welcome. And they could all live there because Joseph had acted after their brothers had a truly shown change. So there's great action there. But I think just in conclusion, as we bring this all together, I just want to return you, if there's one thing you go away with this evening, I want you to go away with verse 8. Because verse 8, let me just remind you, says, "It's not you who sent me here, but God." And if we remember that in everything that we do, each one of us, "It's not you who sent me here, but God." God puts us in those situations for a reason, however hard they might be. And we can feel let down, can't we, by others, betrayed even by those that are closest to us. Maybe our lives have been made impossibly difficult. Maybe we're suffering in a way that others don't even know. But Joseph can identify with every aspect of that, every single aspect. And as he did, we need to do the same and trust in God's great sovereignty. One of the lines in the song we sang this morning said, "From life's first cry to final breath, Jesus commands my destiny." Do we believe that? Do we just sing it, or do we really believe it? Do I really believe that? From life's first cry to final breath, Jesus commands my destiny. It doesn't mean we don't have strong feelings. It doesn't mean we don't feel at times hard done by and that people aren't responsible for what they do. But it does mean that God is working everything together for good, even if at times we can't understand that. And if on the other hand, we might be the ones responsible for letting others down, for betrayal, inflicting suffering on others. Christians aren't exempt from that. But the message of Genesis is there's a way back. And look at Judah's reaction. He confessed his sin and he backed it up by being prepared to offer himself for others. Words and action. Offering himself for others. Does this remind us of somebody? Remind you of anybody? Isn't that what Jesus came for? To suffer, to die for each of us? To be served, to serve and not be served? To take our place, give up everything for us and to offer us real forgiveness? Isn't that what he came to do? Just as we finish, I want to take you back to the Garden of Gethsemane. Because there we have this supremely exemplified as Jesus accepts his betrayal. His betrayal. Because in John 18:11, he accepts his betrayal as the cup which the Father has given me. That's how Jesus describes it. He accepts his betrayal as the cup which the Father has given me. And if that silver cup that Benjamin received in his sack seemed unfair, and perhaps tied up with some sort of divination, then maybe it does point us forward. Maybe it does detect that metaphorical cup that Jesus was going to take as he died on that cross for us. And that wasn't fair, was it? Taking on the sins of all of us when he was a perfectly good, never done anything wrong, he was God's son, and yet took our sins to give us a chance of a way back. And yet, it was part of God's amazing plan. So, the story might be superficially about a family that had been reconciled. But I hope I've got it across to you that it goes far deeper. And this is about a reconciliation with God, with our Maker, with the most important person of all. Being released from the grips of sin. Think of the brothers when they were released from that. The relief they must have felt. That burden had been lifted. Think of Pilgrim's Progress. That burden that was lifted. As the guilt, the deception, the lies, that conscience they had to live with. Suddenly, they were set free. And why? Because of the wonderful forgiveness that God offers to us. And just look at where we finish in verse 15. And this is great. And this is why we need to read passages carefully. Because these words are almost throwaway. And they almost seem a little bit meaningless, but they're really not. Verse 15 is simple but striking. It says, afterwards, his brothers talked with him. Afterwards, his brothers talked with him. What does that mean? It's about fellowship, isn't it? They had fellowship for the first time in such a long time. And that's what God offers to each of us if we ask him for forgiveness and trust in his eternal plan. He offers us fellowship with him. A conversation with him that goes on, as Tom said this morning, for eternity. An eternal paradise that is on offer. A relationship with God that never ends. That is based on his love, his forgiveness, and not based on anything that we have done. We all mess up. We all have sins we need to confess. But God, through Jesus, gives us a way back. And it culminates in an eternal relationship with him and a plan that has been there since the very start. From life's first breath to final cry, Jesus commands our destiny. Amen.